gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, Episode 1, the review segment for Friday, November 29th, 2013. This is our first, actually no, it's our second review segment, but the first was a 0.5. So technically, Jordan Hoffman, you are here to inaugurate this new podcast and its reviews to help us talk about Frozen. Thank you for joining, Jordan.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad once again to be the fifth Beatle of Fighting in the War Room.
I think I think of you as the fifth monkey. Than anything.
Yes. Wait, was there a fifth monkey? There was like the manager showed up.
He wasn't part of the group.
Wasn't there a guy who wears a fez on the monkeys? Oh, that's the Beatles' help. There's a guy who wears a fez.
So it's more accurate as Beatles' fifth.
Yeah, I'm the fifth Beatle. You know, there were a number of fifth Beatles though. There was George Martin was the fifth Beatle. Murray the K was the fifth Beatle. Billy Preston was a fifth Beatle. So there can be other fifth Beatles.
I think of you as the fifth Oneider.
What is Oneider?
Oh, I'm sorry, Wonder.
That's pronounced
that
Wonder.
You do reference?
Yes, thank you.
Good Lord, I'm impressed.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Of which there was a fifth Wonder.
I'm trying to think of a connection between the Beatles and Frozen to get us there, but I can't. So let's just talk about Frozen. Yeah, great music. Well, I think that might be something that we have to talk about. Frozen is a musical from Disney in kind of the tradition of more recently Tangled or Beauty and the Beast or Little Mermaid or pick whatever classic that they want you to compare this to. It is hilariously loosely based on a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. Have either of you read the original fairy tale?
No.
No. Has anyone read an original Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale?
A Danish child from 1935? I mean, who reads that
I'm sure we know some kind of literature.
The closest I've done to reading a Hans Christian Andersen story is sitting through the Danny Kaye movie about his life when I was a young lad. That's about it.
Oh, boy. Well, it's based on a fairy tale, as with many Disney musicals, and it's about these two sisters who are forced to run their magical Norwegian-ish realm when their parents die. The older sister is supposed to take the throne, but it turns out she's got magical powers to control ice and snow, and this freaks a bunch of people out. She's been trying to hide it her whole life. Her younger sister didn't know that she had them. And then she makes a big scene. She takes to the hills and then builds herself an ice palace and sends her kingdom. She accidentally sends her kingdom into eternal winter. So then her sister has to trek off into the mountains to find her and to convince her that everything's okay and bring her back and restore summertime. So it's an adventure story. It's a sister story. There are songs. And there's a talking snowman who is not awful, which is probably the most pleasant surprise that was waiting for me in this movie.
Agreed.
And so I actually would like to start by talking about the music since in our main episode this week we talked about musicals. And Patches, you have some strong opinions about this movie as a musical more so than as a movie, I think. I feel like you're fine with it as a movie, but the music stuff bugs you.
After watching this movie, I was gifted with the soundtrack to Frozen, which I think I am enjoying more and more than the actual movie, which I was not a big fan of. I'm going against the grain on this one. I didn't like it very much. But the music is pretty solid. The music comes from the team behind Book of Mormon, Robert Lopez and his wife, Kristen Anderson Lopez. I think they also did Avenue Q and musicals like that. It's very clever, very listenable. I mean, it's got some showstoppers. Let It Go by Idina Menzel is like the big number of this movie. What I think is interesting about it is that it seems more primed to be a Broadway musical. It's staged like a musical, and I think this works against the movie in some ways. It makes it very small. When you have the animated platform, you can go big, you can go wild, you can defy the laws of physics. Anything can happen in an animated movie. And yet I feel like I'm on a stage watching this thing. And I think I'd rather be because the music is more oriented for that. You have a lot of parallel action that I picture it on a stage as opposed to the way it's composed in this movie or directed.
Now, can you give me an example? Because I just can't figure out parts of this that I automatically look at and think it would work better on stage.
Sure. Well, there are moments where the two characters, Elsa, played by Idina Menzel, and Anna, played by mm-hmm. Kristen Bell, are kind of, at one point later in the film, they're bickering back and forth in this ice castle. And I imagine, because the sound, Let It Go sounds a lot like Wicked. It sounds a lot like Defying Gravity, so it's a little hard to differentiate them. And I just see these two characters kind of interacting, like the camera swooping around them, and they're having this face-off, this dialogue through song face-off. And this is when I'm like, they're not. This is not cut from the same cloth as Aladdin and Little Mermaid, which a lot of people have kind of tipped their hat to in reviews that I've seen, and I think that's just incorrect. I think that's a very easy thing to cling to. This is a totally different type of animated musical because it's staged like a Broadway show. Well, so you have people dialoguing, and then you have this, like early in the film, they're kind of monologuing to themselves about wishing they could kind of escape this world. And again, it doesn't seem, it's staged more like a stage show than it's showstoppers from old school Disney movies, or as we discussed earlier this week, old school like 50s, 60s musicals.
Well, I agree with everything you're saying, but I actually, that's one of the things I really liked about it, because it felt very refreshing to me. Because, I mean, I go into a lot of these family-friendly films ready to hate it. And for me, it's either got to go full silly ridiculous, like some of the recent Sony films. I'm thinking of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. And I'm also thinking about Hotel Transylvania, which I think is really, really good. Or it's got to be classy. And most of the times they fall in between, and I come away not that impressed. But this one, I think you're absolutely right. I think it does feel like a Broadway musical. I'm sure that they had that in mind because, you know, those are big revenue streams for Disney. They own a lot of theaters in New York and, you know, in the Disney World, Disneyland and all that. And the Ice Castle that's Act Two, Scene One, you know, big new set. Curtain rises. Ooh, the ice castle. She's inside. And then the next 20 minutes take place there. I don't see that as a negative. I saw that as, you know, kind of a throwback to more classic films. It felt a little bit old school. And what's kind of interesting is that I happened to see Frozen about 20 minutes after I saw Saving Mr. Banks, which I didn't really like very much.
That's an interesting double feature.
But I liked... Yeah, it was a Disney double feature. But it made me think about old Disney films, and it made me think about old Disneyland and old Uncle Walt himself. And even though I didn't particularly care for Saving Mr. Banks, I came into this sort of wishing, oh, they don't make them like they used to anymore. And then this movie started, I'm like, holy cow, they really do make them like they used to. This is not a very winking film. There is no hint
and
of
I
Shrek
really appreciate
in there at all.
That too. That it takes a stab at some actual. Thematic, you know, challenging themes and have real characters, and it doesn't have to be just anthropomorphic animals going on a crazy adventure.
Right,
I mean, that's why we were all scared of Olaf the Talking Snowman, but luckily that works out because he's
so
very
good.
Much
I
part
don't.
Of the emotional arc here. But for me,
but also it's not very 21st century. It's not very postmodern. No, I don't think it is
thematically.
With one or two little, there isn't very much fourth wall breaking at all.
Oh, okay.
There are no winks to the camera. There are no anachronistic references. There's no references to like pop culture, and that for a kids film, it's pretty rare. And there's no like farting jokes or anything like that.
Right. There are stone trolls in this that have a goofy big number and they're like playful, but they never walk out with like a Hawaiian shirt on.
No.
Stupid. Like that.
Which, again, is fine in the right... It's fine when, you know, because Cloudy the Chance of Meatballs does that to the hilt and does it really well, but this, you know, made the decision not to go that way, and they stuck to their guns, and there's no... Like, I despise the Shrek films. I think they're terrible. And that whole universe of kid films makes me angry. But this, I think, really was... It had good writing and it had sharp writing. And I think that it is, even though you're right that in terms of the setting, it's a little stagey, it is very beautiful to look at. The ice castle is gorgeous. When she's doing her magic snow and ice effects, it's pretty nifty. The big fight scenes at the end are fine. There's a chase. And Olaf the Talking Snowman.
These reference points that you're making for the visuals, because they all take place in one location for a very short span of time in the movie. All the ice castle stuff and the things to do with the Ice Queen or the Snow Queen are a very limited portion of this movie, which I think, you know, going back to how I was comparing it to a Broadway show, I feel like there's a bigger show here. I feel like there's more songs on the cutting room floor. I feel like there's better developed... I feel like there are better developed arcs. And this movie ends up feeling a little choppy to me in a really unenjoyable way. that it just seems like a lot is cut out or a lot had to be stitched together to kind of make it all work. I really don't get enough of either sister in this movie. I mean, it's the focus is mostly on Kristen Bell's Anna as she goes on this adventure with Kristoff, played by Jonathan Groff, who is another Broadway performer who doesn't get a number for some reason.
He sings to his reindeer.
Okay, he plays a ukulele at one point. But I'm like, why do you... That's a it's real tip-off that there's more of this movie living out there somewhere.
You might be right. You might be right.
I want more... I mean, I always want more musical numbers.
Well, I want more musical numbers, but I also just want more character. I feel like I never really get to know Elsa during this movie, and I'm told a lot of things about how people feel, and while I really enjoy the themes that they push and develop during this movie, which are very unconventional for the Disney princess brand, I really don't understand these characters at all, and I don't enjoy the journey because of that. I really can't get on board with Elsa. There's no time spent with her.
It does rush through, and there isn't that much backstory, but I think it wants you to fill in the blanks on your own. I mean, I think kids will get it, and you know what you know, if you had learned the whole family tree or seen more of their childhood struggles, would that have done more? I think they want to get you on the adventure quicker.
No, I'm with you that I want it to take place in the timeline of the story, but there's so much time devoted to Anna and I guess I keep saying Anna, it's Anna, right?
Anna.
And Kristoff, that I mean, Elsa's sidelined. She doesn't have anything going on. She just kind of flees the scene. And I mean, she believes she should be alone. But like, what's her discovery here? I don't really see her having a revelation, just kind of like all of a sudden making a switch. And I mean,
Katie, what do you have to say about
that? Yeah, come on, boys. You're talking all the way over me through this movie that's for girls. Jesus. I think that you're discrediting the animation, what it's giving us about Elsa, especially. There's really interesting stuff, just the way that character moves, the way that she's so uncomfortable in her own body when she's in that dress and trying to hide her powers. And then she has that one big song. That song is her revelation. That's her realizing that she has powers that she wants to take advantage of, that she revels in having the strength. And the rest of the movie is about her learning how to use that and learning that that doesn't mean she has to be an outcast. It's her kind of coming to terms with this power she has that nobody else understood. And the way that this movie subverts the princess thing, I don't think it's that subversive of a movie, but I do like the way they take the... you know, the find your true love and your true love's kiss will solve all your problems for you. And they translate it into being about sisters, which
is great. I didn't see that coming.
I was nervous the whole time that they wouldn't commit enough to that. And I was really grateful that they committed to the sister relationship in exactly the way the story needed to be told.
As I write in my review, I think I said at the end, the princess needs a prince like a reindeer needs a bicycle or something like that. And she really, you know, at the end, she doesn't dismiss the fact that she's got the handsome man, you know, mooning over her, but she's kind of...
Yeah, who wouldn't want Jonathan Groff, the ice farmer.
Plus, he's got his own sled, right? But she's sort of... that's extra. Like, she's really more focused on her sister and on her kingdom, and, like, smooching him at the end is a little cherry on top. That is not the big success. And that, I will admit, I did not see coming. I was ready for Disney to get it very conventional at the end. And then I'm not saying this is a feminist, you know, tract, but when it ended, I'm like, oh, that's really cool that they did that in this movie that I expected another Disney princess. They came correct. And tell me if you disagree.
No, I totally agree, Patches. I think you do too.
What do I not agree with? Or what do I agree with?
No, you agree that it ended it correctly, that it did the right thing with the princess story.
Absolutely. Again, that's why I think that the... thematically speaking, I'm in tune with it. I like what it's trying to do. It's more about the journey. I mean, Olaf is really an enjoyable character who's voiced by Josh Gad in this movie. But I shouldn't enjoy him so much. Like, I shouldn't feel this kind of relief when he comes on screen and like, I'm going to start enjoying the movie again. I want it to feel more fluid. I'm thinking back to all these animated films that I've really enjoyed that seem, I mean, not to undermine it or underappreciate them. They're not that complex. I just wish that maybe the storytelling was a little more fluid here. And I do disagree with you, Jordan. I did not find this to be a very visually pleasing film. I am not a CG animated fan, but I really enjoy Tangled. I enjoyed a lot of the sequences in Tangled. You know, they sing love songs that are set to the lanterns, or they have a big action sequence, or they have the tavern song in Tangled. I thought they were doing a lot with the environments in that film and really keeping in tune with the staging of classic Disney animated films. And here they weren't using the environments at all. And maybe it's because it's all like blue hues and it's not really an interesting palette to play with, but I think they could have pushed the animation further. You can do so much.
I feel like they did okay, but maybe they didn't knock it out of the park. There were a couple of moments that really shone. The opening when they're lifting the ice, that opening scene, the stuff in the ice castle that we've discussed now, and then the scene with the trolls I thought was cutesy, and I thought that Olaf was good. But, yeah, there is like a chase scene where like a snow golem is throwing them off a cliff, and that... They didn't really push the envelope in that sequence. It was sort of like,
I mean, if you're going to go out on a limb and suggest that she can conjure this and she would set this on people, like, yeah. go all the way with that stuff.
It was all right, Snow Golem. It was okay. But let's put aside the visuals. Did you find that the adventure, I mean, it's basically she goes up a hill. The bulk of the movie is this girl goes up a hill.
And then comes back down the hill. And then Elsa comes back down the hill.
That's okay, because that's what, you know, I mean, what's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs? She goes into the woods. She doesn't even go up a hill. Yeah, she just goes to the left.
So, I would so much rather have that than, like, the incredibly convoluted plots of every other, like, action movie that comes out. Like, you think about comparing this to what Star Trek Into Darkness is about. Thank God we've got something that's about...
I'm not complaining about that.
...a goal and what happens to that goal and what she learns about that goal.
I have no problem with a... from point A to B to C. Right. That's not a problem.
My question is for both of you, do you think that there's enough sort of originality in storytelling of the things she does along the way going up the hill? She has wacky adventures up a hill and has wacky adventures coming down the hill.
Well, I thought it could have been more personal and tethered to the themes. Like, shouldn't it be more about the love aspect, the sisterly love aspect, something about that, the relationships of the past, these kind of social pressures. And here we're kind of like she futzes around at a way station buying carrots and stuff.
But it's about her too. Like, it's about her figuring out her purpose as a little sister and having always lived in her sister's shadow.
I felt like it ended up going back to these characters at the castle so often who weren't really important. Like, a lot of the time in the film is spent introducing a cast that's all kind of a red herring, not to be
too spoilery.
What
did you guys think about the world building? Like, because you don't really know where this is set. Is it the real world? Is it history? Is it Middle Earth? You know,
it should have been Middle Earth.
I mean, did you get? I will admit that I didn't quite know what this kingdom did, and there was like another kingdom, and there's like Duke Wesley Snake or whatever who's from another kingdom, and that could have been a little more developed. Or was it just enough? Was it just enough to let you know
it was too much for me?
Really?
It was just like too much stuff. I'm just like, slim this thing down, because these female characters are so interesting. We don't need all these offshoots that end up just being to fool us, or like archetypes. Like, there's an old bad guy who's in the movie who doesn't really do anything. I don't really see the purpose of these characters.
Was there an old
bad guy? Funny though. Yeah. I was amused by him, and the kids that I was like watching chat afterwards were amused by him. I mean, you need an actual bad guy, because you've got the technical villain. I think so.
I think the interesting thing is having Elsa seem like a bad guy and then have someone lingering in the background who shows their face. But there's like an abundance of characters in this movie for some reason.
Do you folks think that this is going to be a like a cultural touchstone? Are kids going to go bananas for this?
I already see people dressing up as the princesses.
Wait, really?
Yeah, during Halloween, all across Park Slope.
Oh, wow.
And like, that's not like America, that's Park Slope. I'm talking about in the real world. Do you
I have a hard time not imagining this movie making $1 billion, because it's the only kids movie coming out this season. But I don't know about like how well do we remember Tangled now?
I mean, I remember Tangled pretty well.
I mean, but like, is it a cultural touchstone? Or
is this going to be as big as Aladdin?
Yeah, we have no idea. We have no
Aladdin
reference
size.
Point.
I'm talking. Well, I mean, will it be a Broadway musical?
Yes, definitely. Then
it will linger for a decade. If they're going to make this a Broadway musical, this is, you know, you're going to have little girls and little boys singing that number, Let It Go, on YouTube for years.
I want to make a YouTube video of me singing Let It Go. That song is damn good. That is a really great song.
And it's also hilarious, because she's the Ice Queen. She's got her hair up. She's all frigid. And then she decides to be true to herself, and she busts out in the sequin gown. She's throwing a little leg. Her hair comes down. It's a riot. I can't wait for little boys and little girls to sing that on YouTube. It's going to be great.
The line from Let It Go, is, she actually says, my soul is spiraling in frozen fractals all around. And I'm like, you said fractal. This movie gets an automatic bump up in letter grade.
There's a movie about ice. They had
it's a big song. It's a big, it's a big.
Well, that's the thing. It's song, it is know? Such a big song. So why doesn't the movie feel as big and momentous when these changes to the characters come? I'm interested in seeing this staged on Broadway because I think it will live and breathe better. It just feels really contained in this movie.
The first rule of show business is to always leave them wanting more. So
I think you say that every time you come on the show.
Do I? It's one of my favorite cliches. Well, I don't know. I mean, the truth of the matter is, and it pains me to agree to this. I do sort of see what you're saying, and I hate to give you any credit, but you have a little bit of a point that the sort of action and the plot mechanics are secondary to sort of just. Isn't this a cool package? Like the songs are great, the characters are great, the costumes great. That there, right. There's a little bit more sizzle than steak, but there still is a lot of steak. It's not all sizzle, no steak, but there's a little bit more sizzle than steak.
I just have a hard time agreeing that there's anything about this that's unenjoyable. Patches, you keep saying that like you start having fun when Olaf comes back, but I feel like every moment of this is so sharp. Like the writing is good, the characters are good, the animation looks good. Like there's no moment of this that I don't enjoy, even if I agree that it could be stronger in parts. Like I wish some of the songs were better, but I wouldn't give back any of the experience I had watching this.
For me, the writing is just not up to snuff, but there's great examples of direction in this movie. I love the last third, just like all the visuals in this snowstorm that ends up happening. There's a great little chase scene it reminded me of a J.J. Abrams or a Joss Whedon, like we're in the middle of action and having a conversation bit where Anna and Kristoff are like fleeing from wolves and they're bantering about like the relationship status. I like those moments and I wish more of the action had been infused with that. Like, let's get to the journey quicker and kind of get through all this, like, we're opening up the doors to the palace, and all these people have always wanted to go in. Like, that takes so long to get through when we're finally on this journey with Anna and Kristoff.
It's about 4 minutes.
I mean, no, it plots. But when you get with these two, they're interesting characters, and they have a nice rapport, and I just wish their friendship was able to blossom in a more elegant way, and that perhaps parallel action could have really involved Elsa into the movie more. I just think the character is really interesting, kind of subverting that Wicked Witch image, and I wanted more of her. And I will say that something I really loved in this movie was Christoph Beck's score. You know, not just the sing songs, but the music playing in the background. He uses this choir, Norwegian choir. That's just like so beautiful. I mean. My favorite part of the movie was the first 10 seconds over the title card because he gets this amazing Norwegian choir and it's
what
wonderful.
A weird, like, damning with faint praise.
Hey, I am who I am.
First 10 seconds.
I like the whole opening number. And, you know, I genuinely like the whole movie. For me, it comes down to this. You got to take your niece and nephew to the movies. Most of the time, these movies are a disaster. This one's pretty damn good. So it's sort of a positive. Katie, how would you wrap it up?
Oh, I would absolutely take, you know, whatever small children in my life. And also, like, my family likes Disney musicals. Like most people my age, I grew up watching the ones from the late 80s and early 90s. And I probably agree. I don't even think this one's quite as good as Tangled. But like I said, there's no moment of this movie that I did not enjoy myself. And if you're not sitting there kind of stacking it up against other musicals and the way that other musicals have done these similar stories better, then this...
I wasn't doing that.
Turn your brain off. It's just a movie. But I do think that even though there are parts I recognize could be better, that didn't keep me from having a big grin on my face most of the time.
Do you want to real quick give a very quick reaction to the short that accompanies the film?
Oh, my God. The 3D in that short.
That's almost the problem with Frozen. The problem with Frozen is that it has to live up to the wonder of Get a Horse.
Oh, come on. It's not that good. The short is fun.
The short is amazing.
It's amazing, but it's just a chase. It's just really clever.
But the problem is if you're going to make me sit through a 3D animated film, like, why are you going to push the envelope the way that these short animators did? I mean, this is amazing.
I'll very quickly give a little context for the short. They took an old Mickey Mouse short from 1930 whenever with actual Mickey and Minnie in black and white in very plain hand-drawn 2D And then some kind of twist happens and it busts out into 3D and there's Mickey on his cell phone interacting with the drawn Mickey on the screen, if that makes any sense. And it's great because I know that Disney really wants to try and get Mickey Mouse to be, he's the most famous character that nobody watches, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, I mean, I'm a lot older than you folks. I don't have any real relationship with Mickey Mouse. You know, I go, you know, you go to Disney World and go, oh, there's the famous mouse that I don't care about.
You're not a fan of his Prince and the Pauper
movie? Because I'm a weirdo, I later in life grew to love Mickey Mouse. But as a kid, I loved, you know, Woody Woodpecker was my favorite growing up. So what do I know? Nevertheless, this is a really cool way to try and make the mouse relevant to today's child.
I think that the 3D in that short is reason enough to see Frozen in 3D. The 3D in the movie itself is fine, but I think that if you don't see Get a Horse in 3D, you really are not getting like the purpose of it.
It was incredible. I mean, it just blew my mind.
Have you guys ever been to like the Muppet Spectacular?
Yes.
Studios in Florida. It reminded me of that when like you're sitting in there and you're like, oh my god, I can't believe that this is how 3D works. And I kind of thought that impact would have been lessened by, you know, the last 5 years of 3D, but it really works in
that. I just don't understand why a movie, a feature film, can't push 3D to that dimension, to have that scope.
It would exhaust you after a while.
I don't think, I mean, to have things on those kind of planes, I don't think so. That's why I'm seeing a 3D movie, right? To really kind of stretch my imagination on that
I think it would
level.
Exhaust the eye after a while. I really do.
I mean, it wouldn't move at the pace of Get a Horse, because that is a frantic film.
Is it online, Get a Horse? Like, obviously,
no,
you
would not. Sure
I hope not.
It right. would be, it's like watching Gravity on a screener. Like, you're not really going to get the thing that you're supposed to be getting from that. Anyway, Frozen. Go see it with all of the young children or the pretend young children in your life, and then yell at Matt Patches for not enjoying the joy of musicals.
Everyone has already, don't worry.
And how.
Question.
Yes, it was in honor of Thanksgiving, which happened already. In honor of the in honor of Thanksgiving, what's 2013's biggest turkey?
Jordan, as our guest, you get to make your own pick.
Well, I you know, one can interpret turkey a number of different ways, something that should have been good that wasn't, or something that was simply bad. I'm going to interpret it as something that everybody that did well. So somebody liked it out there, but I really, really despise. And that's going to be our friend. What the hell's that knucklehead's name? Seth Gordon and Craig Mazin, two non-talents working together to bring us Identity Thief, the Jason Bateman, Melissa McCarthy disaster that horrified me and managed to make a zillion dollars. So it shows you what I know.
Patches, what was your listener pick?
Yeah, I am going to go with, I think I'm going to go with at Osan912 Orlando, who said, you're next. It should have been the next great horror franchise, but Lionsgate screwed the pooch. I am not in agreement over that latter part, that Lionsgate is for some reason to blame for the kind of flop of You're Next. I just don't think it's a very good movie. I think it's just kind of so-so.
Was it a flop? Was it a financial?
I mean, it's hard to say because it didn't cost much. I know they threw a lot of money to market it.
You know, according to Wikipedia, it made $25 million at the box office.
That seems pretty good.
I know that its production costs...
Pennies.
I mean, I would say...
I think they put a lot of money towards...
According to Box Office Mojo.
Say again, Kenny?
It made $18 million, according to Box Office Mojo. But The Conjuring made how much money? Like,
oh
it could
God.
Have made way more than that.
Well, that's the thing, is that they put it out the same weekend as the Jeffrey Dean Morgan Possession. Was it called The Possession? The Jewish exorcism movie from the year ago? I think it's called The Possession.
No. That's not that one, like, a long time ago with Jeffrey Dean Morgan?
Yeah, that was last year.
That's my point. They put Your Next out the same weekend, saying, we're going to take lightning in a bottle.
I see.
So they said whatever that weekend was, September 3rd or whatever, like that's our Possession weekend. And because that movie made an absolute killing, you know, probably over $100 million. And this did not. But I mean, but let's put aside money for a moment. You simply thought it wasn't all that good.
Yeah, I just thought I thought it ran out of steam. I thought it had some really interesting ideas, and it kind of just went to the slasher flick mold really quickly, and I was disappointed on that level. And I think, you know, part of it is the people who really follow movies online saw a ton of praise for an entire year for this movie, and it was supposed to be this revelation, and it's just a cheeky version of the same old slasher movie. And
yeah, but that's you're talking about a very small bubble of, you're talking about us, but it's a very
I'm pretty much talking about everyone who saw it.
Well, I
throwing everybody under the bus.
I liked it a lot, and I happened to have seen it very early at one of the festivals. I think
I do wish I had been drunk at midnight watching your next.
All right.
But
and that is how I saw it. I saw it drunk at midnight with a bunch of friends, and we had no idea what we were going to see. And context matters. When you're drunk at midnight with a bunch of friends and you don't know what you're going to see, and you haven't heard about the movie other than it's good. It can affect you.
Your movies that way. See Frozen that way.
I would probably love Frozen if I were. I would probably sing along.
Drunk at midnight.
I'm going to go with Christopher Meringue at KK Meringue, who was ballsy enough to say, "I love hating Eighth and Body Saints and Elysium equally." And I have really no idea what those movies have to do with each other. I never managed to see Elysium, then I probably won't because no one seemed to like it.
I liked it.
I mean, Eighth and Body Saints is also a movie that I would like to love, but can't quite. But I'm intrigued by the boldness of calling that a turkey. So I picked that less for a green than just for style points.
So people can go after him on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Go find him and
keep on a hating
him at, when you're done hating Patches.
Yeah, that's a weird movie to hate, Eighth and Body Saints. It's a very intentionally slow. It's a patient film, as we like to say.
Sure.
It's a slow burn. It's very beautiful. It's all about what happens in between story points, you know, like something big happens at the beginning, something big happens at the end, but the whole movie is set in between when you're waiting for everything to go down. So it's kind of more interesting than good, but it looks nice, and it's got Ben Foster in it. So I mean, ultimately, I like that film, but it's
man, if you see movies because of Ben Foster, he is taking you down some terrible roads. That's a bad life to live.
I like Ben Foster a lot.
Okay, I think that wraps it up. We are going to be back next week with episode 2 of Fighting in the War Room. I'm going to stop being excited about these low numbers soon. But I'm
why?
Excited.
No, keep being excited.
Okay. I don't think I can be like episode 35 because, you know, we had all these before. But
you got to keep the momentum.
New territory. As a reminder, I know we don't usually do this on the review episode, but please keep leaving us iTunes reviews. We need them badly. It's a whole new start. It helps us a lot. But otherwise, Jordan, tell the people where they can find you online.
Hi. You can read my work at various outlets, including film.com, New York Daily News, Screen Crush, and elsewhere. And you can follow me on Twitter at jhoffman6.
And I am Matt Patches. I am writing across the internet as well. Where am I writing? I don't know. Grantland, Vulture, IGN, lots of places. And I put it all on mattpatches.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches.
And I am Katie Rich. Starting on Monday, you can start finding me at Vanity Fair's Hollywood section. You can always find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Thank you for listening. We'll be back talking to you next week. Bothered me.